Hare Prabhu, Hare Krishna. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. This is the second half of the summary overview of the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita entitled Observing the Armies on the Battlefield of Kurukshetra. We always like to explain to anyone who's here for the first time that these are facilitations. They're not just simply lectures. They're overviews that are done systematically that engage the participants in a little bit of interaction. And that also is taken as part of our offering. We pray to Krishna and the Vaishnavas and Srila Prabhupada that this is a collective offering, that somehow or other our attempts to please them will be blessed and successful. So there is, again, a little minimum amount of participation. And this also assists people who happen to hear on the radio. There is a radio audience that we have to take into account, even though we're particularly focusing on participation with those who are actually physically present. So in these types of situations, we have a variety of materials to assist you in not only understanding the material that you'll be they'll be presented today, but then give you facility, materials, and skills to take with you in your future studies, because studying Prabhupada's books is one of the injunctions from Srila Prabhupada. Systematic study, too, not just occasional reading. It's a systematic, thorough study of the books. So this is an attempt to give participants and those who hear skills. We cover some skills each time, and also some materials to take with you to further your understanding of the particular chapter. These study pamphlets or resource materials are set up pretty much in a regulated way. It's very systematic from general to specific, and there are some pages and charts in there which allow for filling in, because it's been proven by statistics that if we hear something, we remember 20%. If we write it, it goes up to 70%. So that's one of the reasons, too, we do things a little differently. We try to increase the rate at which we learn and also the length of time we retain. And that can be done if the methods and the materials are suited to that. So that's why we do what we do. Some people find this a little strange, but again, it's meant to help the devotees get the full optimum benefit of what Prabhupada sacrificed his blood for, and that was his books. They are the basis of our philosophy. All right, so now if you'll please take out your little pamphlets. Again, some of you are here first-timers. Some of you were here from yesterday. I saw you brought them along. Your learning materials, this is your hard copy. You'll also see on the screen. It consists of two parts, right? It consists of basic information here on the first part, and the second part consists of some charts. And the charts are presented in the original form and beneath them in a blank form. So at your convenience, as you study over this chapter, if you study regularly, and it's recommended to read a chapter a day of the Bhagavad Gita. It's not just something I do once and then I've read it and that's it. That's actually the Kanishtha attitude. One thing that I can say is encouraging, that those of you who are here and you're endeavoring to study, that makes you eligible for the Mandiam platform. If a person is not interested in studying the books, then they have to stay at the Kanishtha platform. And Prabhupada said that's sad, because the chances are they'll fall away. So unless one makes a concerted effort to raise himself to the platform of Mandiam, and that means I try to hear attentively and I chant, and I also try to study systematically. So congratulations, you're eligible for coming to a higher level. It's very important. It's not a minor thing. And actually, advancement is dependent on two things: increased faith and increased knowledge. Not that the knowledge is superficial. We don't try to apply it. But once we know it, we have a better chance of knowing what to apply. Okay. Without knowledge, what do you apply? You don't know. Okay. One last thing about study. Prabhupada Krishna says, if you study this conversation, you worship me by your intelligence. So it takes great intelligence to under Bhagavad Gita. It's not that easy. Most people in the world don't know it, understand it, even if they try. So unless you're a devotee and you're trying, at least you have a good chance. All right? So you see these charts here. today we're focusing on half of the presentation is focusing on the final section, the final topic. We did three topics yesterday. We'll go over the fourth one today, the slides on those. And then the second half is a little unique. It's focusing on historical evidence that the Mahabharata, that Krishna, Kukshetra are factual, that they are not mythological. And that's very important for us to understand, because sometimes we're confronted with that argument and we may not have the information to offer the proper answer, right? You don't have to have a carna, you don't have to have a world war over it, but you can at least say, no, I know this and I can state this. And this evidence is coming from people outside of the devotional realm. They're researchers. Many of them are researchers who have done independent study, and they actually can verify that every word in the Mahabharata is a fact. So we need to know that, because the Bhagavad Gita is in the center. It's in the middle of the Mahabharata. And actually, the war constitutes a fourth of that book, which is a lot, even though it's only an 18-day period. So it's important to know the authenticity of the Mahabharata and the importance of Krishna. He is a person. He's not a mythological figure. And how we can appreciate him more and more. He's here to help us through his book. All right, so you have those charts here. And some of these charts here actually are, deal with the war itself. If you look to the back, you'll see some of them. And I'm taking a lot of this material that's online from sources that call Krishna a mythological figure. But what can we do? Some of the references I can find are actually coming from ISKCON or from the Krishna book. But they'll give the statistics. And the statistics are quite... But they'll say, Abhimanyu is a mythological figure. So we're working... It's what you call it, the material world, right? And they don't accept God. But anyway, you have some charts here from there. And for instance, some are on the formations, the military formations. They just don't go out and start fighting or press buttons and drop bombs. They actually... You see 17 different types of military formations. Some of them are quite famous in the war. And then you'll see rules for battle engagement, although by the end of the war, all the rules were violated. It got to be pretty rough after by the 14th day. And you'll see some key words here, too. We covered that the other day. Okay. So these, again, are activities for you. And you have this fall-down sequence chart, the domino theory. Once the elders are killed, what happens from there on? And is it just gets worse and worse and worse till the whole situation is hellish. So you have that chart there. That's from an old VIG chart. Oh, also inside, these I used to do these years ago before I picked up a few tablet skills, but these are little icons. I would painstakingly make little cartoons. Children like these also. And they're little cartoons here, and for each verse I put a key word and a little cartoon sketch inside. So you can do a little walkthrough of the 46 verses in the chapter. Okay. So you've got a lot of material there. Hopefully you'll find it helpful and keep it and share it with some others. This first section here too, we're going to go over just the main points we attributed to memory yesterday. And you'll find on here a very important section, the list of the names of Krishna and the names of Arjuna, and they're quite significant in this chapter. And reference to where you will find the more detailed explanation of what the reference mean, the nuances of the philosophy, analogies we looked at yesterday, philosophical points we looked at yesterday. And you also have an activity page here where the key word in each sloka has been dropped out and you can write it in. So you get some practicums, things you can do, not just hearing. Because again, it's been proven time and time again, within 8 hours of hearing what I say, you'll forget 80%, and that was 100 years ago. That was the statistics. And by the time, the way you should understand attention spans at this time in Kali Yuga is 10 seconds. Ooh. So that's why we try to keep people on board, connect. And if you can connect, you get more benefit. And this is not just calculus, history, geometry. This is meant to save us, help us go back to Godhead. All right. So now we're going to go over some of the things that we committed to memory yesterday. We won't do all the details here. If you can take a look. I'm going to see this. The mic is in the way. All right, so the most important thing we had on the first, we go back to the retention checklist. These were the things yesterday we drilled, we went over. Again, skills and drills. We give you skills. We learn skills on how to analyze any drama so that we could understand this one. This was the setting, the characters and the place, the place and the persons that are involved. What's the conflict? It's immediately established in the first sloka. Who are the protagonists? Who are the antagonists? And what are the signs of the outcome, predicted outcomes? Who's going to win, right? So that's in any drama, any narrative, and this narrative is an archetype for all things, right? Right. All right, so we know here, we know, and this is the battlefield, right? It's observing the armies on the battlefield of Kukshetra, and yesterday people were filling this in, and you can do that also because you have a place in this first thing to write in that information in either abbreviated form or fill it out, okay? But you have a place to do, this is a little workbook, actually. It's not meant to be. But when we were young in school, our classes had activity books, right? Kept us filling in things, right? The children just didn't sit there for 4 hours and just listen to the teacher. No, they had something practical to do. Engage your senses. Prabhupada understood that, especially in Kali Yuga. If you don't engage all of your senses, they carry you away. And we're trying to engage our senses to think of Krishna at every moment, especially at the time of death, because we all have to face that exam. So observing on the battlefield of Ukshetra, we covered that yesterday. And we also covered that it was the first, right? The first chapter, number one. We also covered that it was in number of slokas. How many? 46. And that was, our link was the number of letters in the Sanskrit alphabet. We always use a link for numerical retention. And then we also covered that there were, okay, what section it is. In the first section of the three sections, in the what section? Karma Yoga section. Yeah, everybody's good. Everybody knows that. You'd be surprised, though, you go outside of, a group of people that study together, and I'm not so sure. All right, so the next thing we covered was, how many topics there were. Does everybody remember? Yes, this is subdivided into four topics, right? And we did a few signals. We first learned the size. I had one gentleman here. He was so sweet. He was elderly. But I said, I hope you join us tomorrow. And he said, oh, I don't need to know all that. All right. But that makes, what you've got it here. Krishna's giving it to you. If you're lethargic, Krishna's not going to give you a chance later. Krishna withdraws anything that's an opulence that we don't take advantage of. It's stated in the Shastra. If you have a gift that he has given you and you don't utilize it, he takes it away. If people right now have probably such a wealth of books and lectures and they're jaded about it, then next life, maybe it won't be there. You can't gamble. Don't take anything for granted. Even your life, at any minute, any one of us could go like that. That's called the material world. So take it seriously what Prabhupada has worked so hard to give us, okay? So we had the four divisions, and we learned that they were 13 and, what, do you remember the other numbers? 7, 7, and? What was the last one? 19, yeah. 13, 7, 7, and 19, all right? For those of you that weren't here, this is coming a little fast, but anyway, we can't be too repetitious. But we also have to be compassionate. Compassion is the key sign of a Vaishnava. If somebody's new, you reach over and help him, bring him along, don't put him down or say, I know and you don't. This is not the Vaishnava spirit. So if someone's new, please say, oh, can I help you or do you understand? All right, we'll fill it in later. And we know the signals, we did signals yesterday. Signals, retention up to 90%. It may look silly, but it works. On an airplane, the people who can't hear, they have a stewardess there and she'll tell you what to do. Put your mask on, go out that way, right? Put your seatbelt on. It's very simple, and it doesn't take much energy. And you won't forget. So our first one was what? Remember? What was our first signal? Preparing for war, preparations for war. And our second one? Signs of victory. That's seven slokas. Seven signs, seven slokas. Seven slokas. And there are seven signs of victory in there. Who's going to win? It's there already. Predicted outcome. And the next section, also seven slokas, is what? Krishna as Bhakta Vatsal. Yes, he serves his pure devotee. He's the chariot driver for Arjuna, taking orders from his devotee and helping him all the way along. And the final section is what? Arjuna's doubts. And this is the internal conflict. We had the external conflict, fratricidal war, two families in the Vedic times. Kshatriyas, if they engage in battle, it's understood. You fight to death. You don't go home unless you're dead or victorious. If you go home and you were the loser, they won't let you in the door. So this is not a tea party. They're all getting together, and it's a fight to death. And also, Dave will be looking at the slides of the 18 days, and we'll see every day this person killed this person. And we'll think, why are we reading them all this? Prabhupada makes a point about that. He talks about this list of warriors, and he said, Sahajas may criticize us for reading these names, or why are they in the Gita? He said, but anything connected with Krishna, why is that battle important? Why are those names? Because Krishna was there. It becomes absolute. So when we look at all these names, we're going to look at 18 slides, and it's very basic what happened on this day, and it's just a list of who killed who. Why are we doing that? Because we have to understand this was a serious affair. We can't identify it. We just read some text, oh, somebody died. This was a major war in 18 days. The bloodshed was so horrific. They say it was just carnage beyond belief. It's a major thing. All right? So we'll be doing that. And five speakers. I wanted to add a point yesterday I didn't add about Sanjaya. We said yesterday he was important in this scenario because he was there describing to someone who couldn't see the battle for our benefit. Right? He sees it. He's not there, but he sees it in Hastinapur. He's not just sitting watching his television all by himself. He has someone there who's blind and doesn't know what's going on, and he has to describe it word for word. But there's another benefit to Sanjaya's role. He comes up again a lot in the 11th chapter, the universal form. Now, why is he mentioned in two places so much? A witness. Have you ever had to sign an important document? What do you have to have there? Right, otherwise Arjuna could be listening to Krishna and telling everybody everything Krishna said, and somebody said, oh, he was hallucinating. Especially when he saw the universal form. Oh, he was having a nightmare. Or maybe he didn't get it straight. But no, Sanjaya is the witness. That's another important feature of why we have all these personalities. They all have everybody has a function. This world is very practical. Okay? And we had listed the six reasons the aggressor can be killed, the names of the pond, the conch shells, and lists again of the names of Krishna and Arjuna, signs of victory. Okay? So got the basics down? All right, so we're ready to go a little further. And then we had taken people to the next level, which was looking at the slides and just the keywords, because that's all we'll do. This time period does not allow to go into too much depth on the purports, but I do try to explain them somewhat as we go, add a little bit. It's there if you've been to classes every day. Overview can't quite cover everything, but we do piece it together and give you the contextual reference for it. One thing that's also very important is that this particular chapter, starting on the 7th, I remember reading it, it was on the 7th of 1973. Prabhupada was in London, and he lectured for 3 weeks consecutively on this chapter. And if you go online, you will find 26 lectures that address every single sloka of the Bhagavad Gita. So if people dismiss the first chapter as being unimportant, I don't think that would be indicative of that, because Prabhupada covered he said something about every sloka, and he didn't miss one, and he was there for 3 weeks. It was completely systematic from sloka number 1 to 46, and some are combined. Some he made brief reference to, but if you wanted to know by number of lectures, 26 lectures is quite a few. And he describes the Vanashram system, the code for the Kshatriya. He describes so many things in depth. So, again, that's 1973. By that time, the movement was pretty far along. It isn't as though he's addressing in 1969 and people don't know anything. So you can see how important this first chapter is, at least in the mind of Srila Prabhupada. Very, very important. Okay, so if you like to do a little study and you want to research further, by the way, I gave out my email yesterday and I did get some people replying. When we put this on Google Drive, for those of you who are enrolled, you can access whatever we find and use. We put it in folders. You can watch the videos you're going to see. You can see all of the you can hear all the lectures that are available. Whatever we did are the resource sources for you. We've tried to put it in kits, ready-made kits, right? So it's not just, life is like that. You can't get it all at one sitting. So at least if you know I can research this, I can go further. Okay? Got that. All right, now we're going to take a quick look at sloka number 28 slide. Abhay's going to take us to the slides. And they're color-coded, by the way. I use the rainbow, the spectrum, to show sequence. Everything we do is logical. I don't just jump around with a pretty color. Sometimes I try to match colors, but I use a sequence. So we're in the fourth topic, and remember, this one was all about Arjuna's doubts. This is the internal conflict that sets up the stage for the rest of the Gita, because the external conflict may look just like a war between two family members, fratricidal, and they're here to kill each other off. But actually, it's a deeper thing, because the arguments that Arjuna is presenting in this section are based on the misidentification of the body as the self. And anyone who has a material body has that problem to a greater or lesser degree. So if you can pinch yourself, and you're made of five material gross elements and three subtle, we made a mistake. This is our prison suit. And it's quite painful. As we get older, we can prove that. And at death, it's quite painful. At birth, it's quite painful. We can't remember birth, maybe, and we certainly don't remember all of our deaths, or we would be too much. But we know that we have disease, right? And we know we grow old. And we know that's not fun. So there's nothing fun in this place. It's illusion if you think it is. So we understand all that. And the Bhagavad Gita gives us the key for eternity, regaining our spiritual identity in our eternal sanatana relationship with the eternal Lord. So that's why this book is so important. It's not just, well, ABC, it's everything. All right, so he has doubts, and these doubts are based on my kinsman, my teacher, my guru, my family, I, me, mine. That is the first symptom of someone who's been placed into bodily misidentification. Now, as devotees, we know that we're not the body, theoretically. I think everybody here knows that. But we may not be on the Brahma-Bhuta platform. That means we're free of the body altogether. We have no connection with the material, the gross or subtle body. That's Brahma-Bhuta. And that's why that person is free. He's up in the spiritual platform with Krishna looking down on the body. The body is the object. It's not the self. This is a very subtle thing. But as one purifies, he is freed of that misidentification. And only Krishna or his pure devotee can do that. We are under the avidya shakti. Krishna is very clever. And only by purity. We can't crash the gates. We can't argue. Only by purification. And this is the purificatory process. Hearing about Krishna, remembering Krishna, serving Krishna, bowing down before Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Okay? All right. So let us begin with sloka number 28. We'll be looking at the key words. We'll run through this quickly because I do want to emphasize the other half. All right? So the first one, and I hope it's, is it clear enough? Sometimes we need to have the papers. So we look at the key word here, because we're going to go through this quickly. And what I do is I take a sloka, and I try to find a word that, for two reasons, either makes this sloka unique for retention, or it's easy for me to depict with a picture, and that helps people. So the first thing that people look for, especially with cell phones now, is a picture. right? People look for pictures first. Take a magazine. What do you go for? You don't go for the text. You look for the photographs. So we give you a picture, and we see Arjuna. And what's he doing? Can you read the word? Is it bright enough? Okay, what's the word? Quivering, right. Now, you have a list of the words, by the way, also. And some of them match with the icon. Some of them I changed. You can follow your icon list. He's quivering because now he's fearful. And it's material fear that he's experiencing, not transcendental ecstasy. In the next slide, he's telling Krishna, it's so bad that what bow is going to fall from my hands? My Gandiva bow is going to fall. Which I never will put down. If I do, I will never put that down. But it's that bad. When he sees two sides, two families ready to kill each other, it hits when you're right there, you know. And so he says, it's slipping from my hand, and my skin is burning. Prabhupada explains when your heart is in fear, your skin burns. These are all transcendental symptoms, but not here. Okay. Next. And I see nothing but what? Misfortune. I don't see anything good coming of this. So he's feeling, in these verses, he's feeling compassion. I think it's from 28 to 31. He's feeling compassion. He's not a demoniac. The other ones are there on the other side. They're there on a material platform. They're not devotees. They want to kill. That's it. They don't care who it is or what for. We're there to fight till death. But Arjuna is different because this is explained also in the 16th chapter. He's divine because he's contemplating the consequences. A devotee will contemplate what's the consequence of my actions, what's the result of my words, what will be the outcome, even the subtle level of my thoughts. A non-devotee could care less. He won't care. Somebody hurts, if that animal's going to make me happy, if he's dead and on my plate, no problem. A devotee won't do that. No way. He'll feel compassion. Why should that thing suffer for me? Okay, next slide. And he sees, there was another picture for misfortune. All right, another one. And the word happiness comes up. Remember we had those four. The first one was compassion. And the second concern was happiness. What happiness, right? What happiness was I feel? Is this the 32nd verse, right? The first, which one? 31, okay. He said, yeah, what happiness would I feel if I kill all these people? Because what we do is not only for self-interest, but concentrated self-interest. I do something to make myself happy and all those who are near me, like my mother, my father, my son, my wife, my husband. So it's extended selfishness, all right? So here we see here, I want to be happy again, but my happy. He's interested, self-interest. But what's the self? If the self is not the body, you are misidentifying with who you are. Okay, next one is what? And he addresses Krishna as who? Yeah, this is where Prabhupada goes on and on and on in all the lectures. Govinda has such deep meaning here because go means cow or senses. And Krishna gives pleasure to the cows and the senses. So you have to be, you do, Krishna, you're going to agree with what I'm telling you, right? We're meant to please Krishna. That's how it works. If you please the center, then you're automatically satisfied. If you try to act separately from the center, there's no hope of happiness. Impossible. No one can be happy without service to Krishna. Guaranteed. He may think so, but it's illusion. The next picture is of the battlefield. Yeah, and now he's explaining why. When all those present before me are arrayed on this battlefield, this is how can I be happy? Everybody wants to be happy. Is anybody here who wants to be unhappy? I don't think so. Unless you're, like a masochist or something like that. All right, next. And what's the word? Relatives. Whose relatives? My, right. And Prabhupada was saying, at least in Vedic times, the my meant something bigger, like even the animals, because in the war they used the elephants and they used the cows. Animals actually were considered part of the culture. They're with part of the family. Now, some people may have a dog or a cat, and that's part of the family. But they'll eat the cow. But here, you know, he's saying, but my real, Prabhupada said, but my means, everybody, we're all brothers and sisters, folks. Who's the common father? Go back on the genealogical table, it's Krishna. So unless you understand how broad the concept of my is, you won't be able to act as a Vaishnava. Not possible. All right, so now the next slide, well, the key word was what? Can you see it? Is it pleasure? Is it pleasure? Pleasure. Notice how many times these words come up. Pleasure, mine, relatives. Pleasure. Yeah, at one, even if we win, what pleasure will we have? Everybody will be dead. If you have something really nice and you have a kind heart, you share it. Well, come over and I have so much prasadam. Come and help me honor prasadam, right? Or have a guest. You want to share your opulence. That's why a devotee, if he's a preacher, if he's really a preacher at heart, he wants to share the gift that Prabhupada gave him. He wants to share it. So what pleasure will I get if I don't have anybody to share anything with? I'll just sit in my room alone? No. All right, next. Now, the next one, the third fear was sin will overcome us. That starts sloka number 36. He's now contemplating what we're about to do is very sinful. To kill superiors, especially a guru, a grandfather. This is a sinful reaction for this. And they may be evil in their intentions, but we're not. Somebody else may be bad, but that doesn't mean I descend to that platform. Sin will overcome us if we do this. You've probably heard these verses, but anyway, that's just the essence. The picture is there to help you see the demarcation of the arguments. This is his third one. I don't want to be involved in sin. The next slide, and their hearts, I have a couple for this. Their hearts are overtaken by greed. When people are in the mode of passion, it means they're under the influence of lust to the point where if it's satisfied, they become greedy. If it's not satisfied, they become angry. Neither of which states elevate a person to the platform of goodness. Unless a person is in the mode of goodness, he cannot check himself. In the mode of goodness, he will say, wait a minute, that's wrong. He'll check himself. But in passion and ignorance, he's compelled, even if he knows it's wrong. Dhritarashtra was like that. He knew what he was doing was wrong. Duryodhana couldn't care less. So here, their hearts are overtaken by greed. Next. And there's another picture again of Duryodhana. His face indicates the index of the mind, right? You look at a person's face and you pretty much can figure out what the mentality is. If they're smiling, they're joyful, they're probably in the mode of goodness. And if they're... they're probably not. Okay, next. And it's a crime. They cannot see the crime, which introduces the section on the deterioration of the dynasty. This is a crime, not just individuals on a battlefield killing each other. The kinds of people that we are about to kill will mean the destruction of an entire dynasty. And that is the fourth and really most terrifying prospect. These are not ordinary fighters on the battlefield. They're heads of a dynasty. All right? This is, and they may not see it, and here we have the pictures, obviously, just a simple one of the dynasty. You see Dhritarashtra and Pandu and Vidura, right? Vidura was obviously not the family. He didn't create any progeny, but you see the five Pandavas and then the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra. We're talking about major impact for future generations. All right, next slide. And then what happens when women are left unprotected? Well, the world will tell you right now what's going on. It's not a pretty picture. They're exploited, and sometimes they don't have the common sense to do the right thing, or the willpower, perhaps. Or victimized, sometimes just victimized. The children become unwanted. Unwanted children are not what you call creating a strengthy personality, a strong personality. They don't even have often the samskaras to perform what's necessary to attain spiritual salvation. they become weaker and weaker spiritually, more and more degraded, more neglected, and then the world is flooded with that kind of personality. It becomes hellish. So this is what happens when the women are not protected. And if all the men are dead, what does that leave you? Okay, and then the next argument he's saying, and then what's the result? Hellish situation. That painting is actually not relevant. This is relevant for the seventh canto, but I have another one too, where you see, what happens to women that are victimized by unscrupulous men, and that's mentioned in the purport. You know, they're victim. Actually, any jiva that has entered the material atmosphere, Prabhupada said, has come looking for victims. Pretty scary, huh? They're going to either victimize the material energy or people or thing. Looking for victims. So think about that. What goes under the name of love is actually somebody wants to victimize somebody else to satisfy his senses. It's not a very pretty place. Okay, the next one is, and then all community projects will be devastated. Not only will we lose the dynasty, but, you know, welfare work and community projects. This happens to be a photograph of one of the civilizations along the Saraswati River. But you see, these were ancient civilizations at that time. And when a civilization declines, that's what happens. Nothing's left. All right, next. And then he says again, and what's the result? And those who do this, who are involved in destroying the dynasty, what's their destiny? Hell. Right. They'll have an appointment with Yamaraj. And he will send them to a not-so-happy place. And that's a fact even now. People who don't believe in the scriptures, who don't believe in hell, who don't believe that there's a Yamaraj, who don't believe that everything we think, say, and do is being recorded, and death will get the results. Just like if you go into a store now and everything's on a computer and you buy so many items, they just go, they read the code and you have to pay the amount. You can't argue. Our bodies after death are not in our hands at that point. Right now, it is. Whatever we are now was the result of our past accumulated activities. Whatever we do now is creating our future body, spiritual or material. Nobody else can be blamed. It's a serious thing. So he's worried about, will I dwell in hell forever if I kill all these, you know, these dynasty heads? All right, next. And again, the word of joy comes up, because now he's arguing, and this can be the final argument. Bergeon makes that point in his book, his decision as being the fifth one. What's better, perhaps? But he's saying here, well, how can we enjoy world happiness even if we're just here intent on killing our kinsmen? Right? Remember, the whole book is based on initially his chapter, misidentification with the body. Until Krishna becomes the guru in the second chapter and he starts with enlightening. No, you're not the body. So that changes the whole paradigm. Well, then if I'm not the body, who am I? What does that mean? What should I be doing? And the whole book is meant to take us to that level. This is not an ordinary book. You think anybody outside of spiritual life knows this? They're not the body? Just look at the ads. Fingernail polish, eye makeup, clothes. The degree to which they think their body is the degree to which they're still suffering sinful reaction. That's heavy. Because only when you're freed of sinful reaction are you allowed to even get this information. Those of you who are sitting here have been blessed to the degree that you're not suffering as much sinful reaction. And the more you purify, less and less sinful reaction, and more knowledge comes, which takes you to, it's like reinvesting in higher, higher levels. You don't lose in spiritual life, but you lose in material life. Okay, next. And he says, I would rather die unarmed than resist. Prabhupada, in a beautiful purport on this one, talks about counteraction. He takes the first word in that Sanskrit in the sloka. He said, everything in material life is counteract. counteract. If I'm hot, I counteract with a fan. If I'm cold, I counteract with a sweater. If everything is, because everything's miserable, and all I ever do is counteract misery. So, but this doesn't work in the warfare with the Kshatriyas. If someone's unarmed, the other person cannot kill me. They have to drop the weapon as well. If they're not on chariot, they get off the chariot. So he's thinking, but they may kill me even if I'm unarmed, but I'm not going to counteract. So it's interesting how this one works. Okay? And the last one is, finally, final sloka, he's feeling grief. And in the purport, Prabhupada explains, he said he's overwhelmed with grief. He sits down in the chariot, but Prabhupada writes, he said, he's a soul who's ready for self-knowledge. He qualifies. And that's what happens in chapter 2. Okay, so everybody got an idea now of the fourth section and the arguments? Understand it? And again, there's a lot of information available. We can't go, oh, it was such a short time, but we've tried to give you extension materials. Okay? All right, now we're going to quickly put on a little music, and we're going to go to a place called Kukshetra. Because this part of the presentation is meant to give us the information that strengthens our faith that Kukshetra is quite real, the battlefield took place, Mahabharata's true. That's what this part is. So we're going to listen to a little bit of river music, and we're going to take a visit there with some slides. And these are slides that we made a couple years ago, and I didn't have time to remake them. They look a little bit, you know, it's always a learning process. I'm not even expert now at designing, but I try my best, and I hope Krishna will accept. No, you got the wrong one. We're going to Kukshetra, the historic. First, we're going to prove the historic one. We're not ready for the battle yet. Well, we could do that, all right? Should we do the battle first? Okay, leave it on. We have a little march music for this. We're going to look at the battle, because actually if we go to Kukshetra now, it's history. So maybe this is Krishna's desire. All right, so we're going to do a quick day-by-day summary, and most of it you'll see is not maybe so relevant for much of this here, but we stress, Prabhupada said, these names of these personalities are important because Krishna was there. He said, if the Sahaja tells you this is not important, just listen to the gopis' love of Krishna. He said, uh-uh. On the tattva platform, it's equal. On the rasa platform, it's different. But on tattva platform, it's the same. He said, we cannot cut it out. All right, so here we go. Day by day, and on day one, let's see what happens on day one. What happens on the first day? Yeah, it doesn't look so good. Doesn't look so good, right? And day two, what happens? Now you'll see that goes back and forth. And again, there, if you go in on the line, they will have whole paragraphs on who did what and what happened here and there. And this is not our purpose here. But just to give you an idea that this was carnage. And the other problem I had was finding pictures that weren't so many that ISKCON artists dwelled upon. So they were either coming from Wikipedia, which says it's a myth, or they were coming from deviant art, which just creates these sort of low-level demoniac personalities. But it's the best I could do, so that's my choices. Okay, day two, it's great losses for the other side. Who? Kauravas on that day. And on day three? Yeah, some celestial weapons. And I think this was the day that Arjuna protected himself with a ring of arrows. There's a lot of mystical things happen, okay? What happens on the fourth day? Yeah, all along, this is not a good idea. War is starting to get pretty heavy now, right? Each day you read the carnage gets worse and worse and worse. Actually, from day five to day eight, that's pretty much they summarize it. It was too much, and it didn't look good at all for the Pandavas. In fact, Krishna got so worried he picked up the wheel. Okay, so what happens on the fifth day? You'll get a lot of personal details where Satyaki is in trouble and Bhim has to come in and do what? He has to try to save him, right? So dramatic details. Some of you have read the Mahabharata or experts. I'm not. I'm just doing my best to try to share the highlights. Okay, next. What happens on the sixth day? Yeah, no, you see one day one way, the other, we don't know who's going to make it and who's not. So it's back and forth. This is the problem with material life. No permanent solution. There isn't one. Only solution is transcendence. Okay, and what happens on the seventh day? Oh, yeah, now the Kauravas again. Right, they're victorious. What about the eighth day? And see, it goes back and forth. One day it looks good, one day it doesn't look good. And you see that. And that's sort of, in fact, it's not even black and white. You know, some of the things they do, you think, well, wait a minute, was that the right thing? And then, but they're, you know, there's a revenge. The material world is like that. It's not black and white. And there's no end to it. Never stops. What about the ninth day? Yeah, this is, okay, Krishna said, look, he doesn't say anything, man. He just picks up the wheel. If I don't step in, these guys are going to lose. But who stops him? Arjuna, look, and you made a promise. Don't break your promise. What kind of people will never believe anything you say? They'll never believe anything you say. He's about to kill him. But on that same day, it's not so well known, Bhishma tells Krishna, I will not kill a eunuch. He gives him the secret to victory. And that happens to be Shikhandi, who was the brother of Draupadi and Drishtadyumna. I will not kill. So who does Arjuna hide behind? Now somebody say, what kind of warrior are you? But who's advising? Krishna. Okay, how about on the 10th day, what's going to happen here? Yeah, Bhishma finally. He falls. He doesn't actually die on this day. He waits till the sun moves north. And that's the day he's been given that boon. He chooses the time of his death. And he's purified enough that Krishna's there and he sees his Lord at that point. He was actually at the point where Krishna was coming with a chariot. He's ready to go ahead. You're God. You're Krishna. You're my worshipful Lord. I stand there. But it shouldn't end this way. This is okay. There. And he's advising Yudhisthira now how to rule the kingdom. On the 11th day, what are we getting on the 11th day? And more fighting back and forth. Drona, and, you know, this is his teacher. He taught him how to fight. This was very difficult, right? On the 11th day, he defeats Drona. And then what do we have now? Oh, this was an interesting one. Not so well known, but I thought it was a picture I found. It was some warrior, Bhagadatta. Some of you may know this. He was on an elephant. And he was pretty hard to defeat, a great warrior, but Arjuna defeats him. Okay, and 13th day, this is right. Drona is now in charge of the army because Bhishma's out of the picture. You get 5 changes of generals on that side. They just kept dropping off. So at this point, Drona is in charge, and he arranges the famous Chakravyuha, which is almost impenetrable, but if you get in, you can't get out, unless you know the mantras. And Abhimanyu doesn't know the mantra out, he knows the mantra in, and then they said, don't worry, we'll come and get you, but then they close it up. And Abhimanyu was only 16, Prabhupada said, such a great warrior. I think he killed about half of the troops inside. It took 5 other generals to kill him. But that was not fair. He was in the middle. So we get retaliation, and he's famous for that. 16-year-old. Okay? Quite a warrior. We cannot even imagine warriors like this. On the 14th day, retaliation, Arjuna says, if I don't kill Jayadratha, I'm going to immolate myself. So everybody says, let's protect Jayadratha, because then Arjuna will have to die. So this one was unusual, too, because Krishna stepped in again. He kept the sky looking as though it was dark, right? It was dark. Like, it's still light or something, like dark, I think, and then he kills him. He takes his head off. We can look at pictures and not identify, but to imagine to be there and see this happen? Pretty heavy. 15th day, let's see what happened. Right. In other words, just a human is able to kill Drona because Drona thinks Ashwatthama has been killed. And Yudhisthira speaks the half-lie, but it was the elephant. And Drona, at that point, he sits down and he meditates. And this, too, you may question. He's meditating. He's not even fighting. And Drishtadyumna, what a war, huh? And on the 16th day, Now we get another one. Yeah, Bhima, this was his promise. This one again. He I think he breaks his arm or something, takes the blood, drinks the blood, uses it. You know the kumkum that ladies wear? That's actually symbolizing the blood that they use, the kshatriyas used to put on it. I don't know, we should be so grateful to Lord Chaitanya that the process is chanting Hare Krishna. Oh, you can't relate to this kind of thing. We don't have to do things like, we just chant Hare Krishna. It's safe, it's cheap, no violence. Can you imagine? I don't think most of us would have the stomach for this. Okay, 17th day. And Arjuna, now he's Karna. And again, you know, the guy's on the ground, he's off his chariot, the wheel is sunk. What does Krishna tell him to do?
Kill him.
And Prabhupada says, if Krishna orders it, it's good. Because he knows the whole picture. You see, he's allowed that. He's called the divine autocrat. Because he's the only personality who knows everything that was, everything that is, and everything that will be. We don't know. We don't know what we did. Doesn't look so good. But we don't know where we're going. But Krishna does, and he knows the whole picture. So he's entitled to that kind of a decision. That's why Prabhupada said, if Krishna says it's right and it looks wrong, what do you really have to say about it? Okay, number 18. And on that day, right, Bhima, if there's anybody that's going to kill Duryodhana, right, it's Bhima with the club. And he also hits below the belt. Even wrestlers aren't allowed to do that, right? He hits below the belt. And then that pretty much, then this is an interesting personality. I should have read a little bit more about it, but as I was seeing these related topics and get off the track, but there was a personality called Barbarika or something like that. And before the war, Krishna was trying to find out how long the war would take. And Karna would say, oh, we can do it in 20 days, or somebody would say, well, we can win in 30 days. But this guy, he was asked, he has a special boon, he has triple arrows there. He says, the war can end in 1 minute. And Krishna said, what? And he tests him on it. And I cannot remember the details on what he did to test him, but Krishna tricked him. And he asked a boon. You see, you know about Barbarika? Anybody here does? I don't want to get the details wrong, but he is tricked by Krishna, and then he has to do what Krishna says. And Krishna says, I want your head. So Krishna obviously didn't want the war to be avoided. He wanted the war to take place. He had the power to end that war with three. He had some kind of special weapon. And he had to hand his head over to Krishna. But he said, I just want one thing from you, Krishna. I just want to see the battle. So he was another witness. He was placed on a hill, and he watched the war. And that head apparently is in some temple worshipped. Did you see that? I cannot follow all these things. Believe me, I can understand it, but I don't disbelieve it, right? All right, so that was it. So now let's go to Kurukshetra at the present right now. And see some evidence of that this is a real place. It's 100 miles north of Delhi. How many here have ever been there? We've got a few people who've been there. Okay, one, two. How many? Three, four, five. Okay, you've been there. Most of us haven't, so let's go on pilgrimage, right? We'll just take a... Thank God for technology. All right, Kurukshetra. This is a list of some of the... you see it's there on the map where it is, right? North of Delhi, about 100 miles. And it's between two rivers, right? It's stuck between the two rivers. Quite a large area. And these are some of the sacred places there. There are actually hundreds. And they're not just in Kurukshetra. Some of them border over into Punjab, right? Sacred area, like that. So we're going to take a look at some of them here. I think I took most of them on the list. Again, many of the current books will say Saraswati River myth. The riverbed is there. It's you have to be in denial to say these things. So we're going to take a look, and here was the Saraswati and these two rivers. Okay, it's the Drishtavati rivers, those two, and that Kurukshetra, do you see it? It's there between the two rivers. And there is actually the source of the Saraswati. It's there. You can go further north, and it's there. There's so much evidence, really, but you should know that. So you can say, wait a minute, somebody starts arguing with you. No. There. Okay, next slide, we're going to see some proof. Yeah, the Brahma Sarovara. That's the biggest man-made tank in the world. It's huge. And on eclipses there, especially solar eclipses, one was in 2006, 1 million people went there. 1 million. It said if you take bath there, it's equal to an Ashwamedha sacrifice, and all your sins are absolved. And it's the place where Lord Brahma, according to the Shastras, created the universe. So it's called Brahma Sarovara. It's the hub. It's very spiritual. Kukshetra is a very spiritual place. Very spiritual place. Now, can you see how big the tank is? It's huge. Huge. Okay, next slide. And Samantha. Now, this one's in the Krishna book. That this was Parsaram created 5 lakes, right? And this was, they were filled with the blood of all the warriors that I think he had fought for, was it 21 times, or 27 or 21, I forgot which, how many times he killed the Kshatriyas. So those tanks are there. And the next one, you go there. Yeah, this is, it's in Pewau. It's where Krishna took the Pandavas. This is where Prithu had also honored his forefathers. And these places, even by the states, are so sacred that you are not allowed to have non-vegetarian food there. No animals can be slaughtered there. You can't serve, cook, eat meat there. They actually honor the sacredness of these holy places. You wish Vrindavan would have that kind of protection. So that, and Krishna took the Pandavas there to beg from the Saraswati River blessings before the fight. Okay, next. And this is where Arjuna puts the arrow in the ground so Bhishma can drink water from the Ganga, right, the Man Ganga. The arrow, the water comes and he's drinking that. That's there. That tank is there. You can see these holy places. And the next one, is that the last one we have? Oh, yeah. And this is when Arjuna slays Jayarata. That's the place where Krishna raised the chakra. Right, they covered the sky. And again, another one for the Banganga. Any other ones? Oh, yeah, and that's the wheel, the trench, where the wheel sank. And Karna gets off the chariot, and that's where he's killed. So that trench is many, like over hundreds of tirthas there, not just a small amount. We're just touching on. And this is the place where the chakra vyuha was formed. They chose Kukshetra because it was such a big area. There was sufficient water there, and there was sufficient wood for a big war. And this is the place. There's a place there where Dadichi had his hermitage, and he is there where he was. He gave up his body to be made into the weapon for thunderbolt for Indra. He sacrificed his body. That tirtha is there. There's a tank there also. And then this historical review. All right. Okay, so we see some of the remnants there, history. This is all historical. This is factual, not myth. Any other slides on this section? Okay, that was it. Now we're going to take a quick look at a video that will prove to you, and it's short. We have some slides. Do we have a few of the slides on that one, Abhay? Just previous slides. This is very, very interesting because it's almost Gorpranim, and we showed this video 2 years ago on Christmas Day, and I was thinking, oh my God, I hope this is not a sign of the future. Because actually this particular series of videos verifies that the Mahabharata, according to astrological calculation, is 100% correct. So we have here a brief clip from we'll be looking at a 5-minute video. I'm just showing you some slides because it goes fast, and you need to know the technical information because not all of us know much about astrology. But the first video is on Dwarka, and it's being narrated by obviously a devotee. He doesn't say that. And I know the text he has is coming from the next video you will see, which is hard to understand because the gentleman's from America. He's Indian bodied, and he's the researcher who researched all of the astrological calculations that prove every calculation. There are 140 calculations in the Mahabharata that tell you the astrological configuration of the times, and they've been proven. So this particular person, and you'll see him later, if you get the whole video, he's speaking with Michael Cramo, who's a devotee, and it proves that this book is factual, 100%. Okay, so here is a picture of this gentleman. He's in America, and he's a professor, I believe, of physics in Memphis. Okay, and you'll see movies later. Just some pictures of him now, and another slide, and he's going to be talking about how they used solar and lunar eclipses, they used star formations, and they used meteors and asteroids and comets and planetary configurations to prove what the date of the war was and the authenticity of the information in the Mahabharata. So in the next slide, very quickly, we'll go through this. And the most important salient feature, there were two comets, red, fiery comets. They're mentioned in two of the Parvas. Okay, next. Yeah, you'll see there were, now that's not one, two. And they're and you'll see it's sort of scary. You'll see how even when these conjunctions of planets and stars, how even in recent times that same configuration produced a terrible event. So it's not just myth, even for today. All right. So you'll hear we have Aldebaran. Aldebaran, and that is for Saturn. Saturn is an inauspicious planet. You'll get two planets in this. You'll get Saturn and you'll get Mars. Which planets? Saturn and Mars. And the position of Saturn in Aldebaran, and the other one, we use another slide, the position of Mars in retrograde. That means going back. When Mars is favorable, if it's going, but if it goes backwards, the opposite happens. If it's going forward, rainfall, good. But if it goes backwards, bad news. So Mars was in retrograde in what position? Antares. Okay? Antares. Now, this researcher figured out when those two planets are doing the same thing, how many times does that happen over a period of years? So this is getting pretty technical, but that's why we're showing this. I try to follow it. So the next slide we're going to see, yeah. Then he figured out during the month of Kartik. This was mentioned in the Mahabharata. So this helps him isolate Mars, Saturn, Aldebaran, Antares, during which month? Kartik. This battle took place at that time. Next picture. And we see also that it was, it's situated in Taurus. All right, Aldebaran. Next picture. Is that it? All right. Now we're going to watch the video. It's 5 minutes. He's repeating what you're going to see later, lengthier. But it's in 5 minutes, and it's clear. You can understand this. He's a devotee. You can see his tilak. But he's very clear, and his video is all about Dwarka. The Dwarka is Dwarka's real. They found it underneath the ground. It's there. Everybody knows it's there. But it's myth. Don't worry about it. All right, so now, can you hear everybody? Now listen carefully.
Came from astronomical references, which were discovered by Dr. Narahari Achar, a professor of physics at the University of Memphis, who is the world's foremost researcher of the astronomical events described in the ancient texts. Traditionally, Indians have believed that the war took place about 3000 BC, but modern scholars who have a more critical approach to the study of the epics take a different view. Professor Achar said that there are many types of astrological events referred to in these ancient texts, consisting of eclipses and comets and conjunctions of planets with different stars. The most intriguing part of these astrological events is the appearance of two fiery comets. Professor Achar identified in the Mahabharata that there were two comets with blazing coppery red heads. These two comets were mentioned in not just one book, but two of the books of the Mahabharata, namely the Bhuti Yoga and the Vishnuparvas. In conjunction with these comets, he noted that the texts also mentioned that Saturn was at Aldebaran and that Mars performed a retrograde motion near Antares. Professor Achar then used several different pieces of astronomy software to determine the date in the Mahabharata and the existence of Dwarka. These pieces of software enabled him to view the night sky as if it would have appeared any time in the past, and so he painstakingly reproduced the exact night sky eclipse occurred in the month of Kartika and took place at Pleiades, which is located in the constellation of Taurus. After this occurs, the Mahabharata mentions that it is followed by a solar eclipse near Antares. Dr. Char took this evidence and searched for the years 3500 BC to about 500 AD and found there are 137 such conjunctions where Saturn is at Aldebaran. When we see Saturn's transit at Aldebaran, it's usually an event which is even today considered by Indian astrologers to be associated with great wars and violent events. One recent event where the transit of Saturn at Aldebaran,
the Twin Towers went down on that same day.
Saturn's retrograde,
the same configuration the day the Twin Towers went down.
Dr. Char then searched for years in which Mars performed a retrograde motion near Antares. It turns out that this reduces the date from 137 to just 17. After narrowing this down to just 17 dates, he looked for years where there was a lunar eclipse in the month of Kartika, and this reduced the set from 17 to just 2. These 2 years identified by Professor Achar were 2183 BC and 3067 BC. One last final piece of conclusive evidence solved this puzzle. In 2183 BC, the winter solstice occurred in the waning phase of the moon. In 3067 BC, it occurred in the waxing phase, and the waxing phase is exactly what was written in the Mahabharata and what Dr. Achar was looking for. A careful study of these ancient scriptures yields data about a lunar eclipse in October of 3067 BC, which follows the solar eclipse at an interval of 13 days, exactly how the epic describes it. The evidence presented by Professor Achar overwhelmingly 3067 BC as the year when the great battle described in the ancient texts of the Mahabharata took place. Because the astronomical dates and the events described in the Mahabharata have been authenticated by modern scientific method, it is reasonable to conclude that the Mahabharata itself is a factual description of events that took place during that time.
Okay, there are some details I hadn't pointed out, but that we should know. The Dr. Achar uses software to recreate the sky at any time in history. And he used a period from, I think it was 3500 to 500 AD, 3 BC. And he narrowed it down, and he found 137 instances where these configurations were the same. But he narrows it down further to 17, and then he reduces it further to 2, and then between the waxing or waning of the moon, he brings it down to 1. So he has no doubt that conclusively the war took place was, it was in the second one, was it 367? That was the time the war took place, because it was mentioned that that was the moon was waxing at that point, not waning. And the important thing to know there is that he has recorded every 140 references. So we're going to see him now speaking. He's hard to understand, but whatever he said, this earlier personality, I thought, made it clear. So now you've seen some slides. So let's meet Dr. Achar. Okay, go ahead. He's hard to understand, but again, you have enough information to appreciate what he did. He's given his whole life to this.
Based on this. painstakingly reproduced the exact night sky for every reference to it in the Mahabharata. Professor Archer again.
Also, the types of astronomical phenomena referred to in the epic, such as how Omurta and then eclipses, comets, and the conjunctions of planets in different stars, and so on. Illumination for what? Vyasa, which in the Vyasa are evenly worn. And besides to him, the omens that he can see.
These omens predict the imminent war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, and the terrible events which will befall both the Kuru family and the general population. The most significant of these omens is the appearance of two fiery comets.
The day the Twin Towers were...
Started and all that. But to have definite information from the Yeti that the war did not start and could not have started on an alarm yet. Because on the 14th day of the war, they break all rules of war. The war continues in the night, and the break day break only by the moon rises and the 3 hours early in the morning. That the war has started on an alarm yet. The 14th day would have been the relaxing day, and the moon would rise early in the evening and not early in the morning.
Moreover, a careful study of the epic yields data about a third eclipse in October 3067 BC, which follows the solar eclipse at an interval of 13 days, just as the epic describes. The evidence presented by Professor Aja overwhelmingly pinpoints 3067 BC as the year when the great battle described in the Mahabharata took place. Detailed examinations of the astronomical references mentioned in the Mahabharata showed that they were based on real astronomical events that actually took place, and are not a writer's imaginary description. Because the astronomical dates and events described in the Mahabharata have been authenticated by modern scientific method, it is reasonable to conclude that the Mahabharata itself is also a factual description of events that actually took place. In acknowledging this, we are bound to recognize that Krishna, one of the Mahabharata's principal characters, must have been based on a real person. If we also take into account the archaeological evidence that handed down by the Indian oral and living traditions, we are led to the inevitable conclusion that Krishna did actually exist. Whilst the evidence doesn't prove that he performed miracles or had supernatural powers, does clearly authenticate that there was a real person, a man of quite extraordinary powers called Krishna. Skeptics may be doubtful, but let a believer have the last word.
I am like the lotus flower, and Krishna is like the sun. And although there is such a great distance between us, I open simply due to your rays. And without you, how could I even exist?
So, anyway, pretty amazing, huh? So there's definitely proof the Mahabharata is not a myth. Krishna is not a myth. That was a little bit long and difficult to understand, but at least I hope you have a little bit of scientific proof now, according to any researcher, that we can feel safe. The Bhagavad Gita is what we can put our faith in. So thank you for staying so long, and we have